Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, true history from Hollywood. Later on, it's memoirs of the movies with Hollywood at Home, featured from 1959. But first, a tribute to Humphrey Bogart, hosted by Hollywood reporter George Fisher, broadcast the day before his funeral on January 16, 1957 on NBC.
Did you run out on me because you couldn't take it, because you knew what it would be like? Hiding from the police, running away all the time? Well, I'm not running away anymore. I'm settled now.
Bogart was a truly professional actor. He survived in a pretty rough business. And the greatest kick he got out of the motion picture business was the night he won the Oscar for the best performance by an actor for the movie African Queen in 1952. This reporter, at Bogie's request, was master of ceremonies the night of that great movie premiere. And I was also present when the star won the Oscar. He was never so nervous, up and down, out of his seat 100 times, waiting for that final decision. A decision Hollywood knows is also based on the popularity of the star with his fellow craftsmen. What was that part like? Well, certainly it was not the gangster role he was famed for, but rather a kind of riff-raff captain of a shabby riverboat, the African Queen, a picture in which he really hit big time, co-starring with Katharine Hepburn. It was Bogie's fifth association with director John Huston, beginning with The Maltese Falcon. And the stories of the so-called feud between Bogie and Katie were far-reaching and apparently far-fetched. As he once told me at his home in Beverly Hills after making the film, when I asked him if it was a real feud.
No, there was never any friction between Katie and myself because I love Katie and I think Katie loves me. We got along splendidly. You see, I'm a natural-born griper. I just gripe at everything, and I'm kind of like a GI in the Army, you know. Gripe about the food, gripe about the conditions, but go ahead and do the work. Whereas Katie used to drive me crazy by, as you say, she loved everything. The natives were divine, the heat was divine, everything was divine with Katie. And I used to get kind of sore at her, but only in a mild way. Because I thought she was nuts, which it turned out I think she is. She loved every minute of it. She would like to stay there for the next 6 years.
Did? You certainly leered when you said you'd like to stay the next 6 years. Did your wife enjoy the trip, or was she on your side or Katie's side?
No. My wife was on Katie's side, and they were both on John Huston's side. As a matter of fact, I think he's slightly nuts, so I guess I was the only one who thought it was too hot and too damp, and why we were there, and the food was lousy, and so I just, I was kind of like that angry man in the box. I just drank my scotch and griped.
The Bogie seldom griped in Hollywood. His name pulled at the box office, and he was a fine actor. In the process of making some 70 movies, he acquired a brassy air of confidence and command. And though he wasn't a big man, he was able to transfer to the screen an illusion of size and toughness and unmistakable menace. And in these later years, he played a surprising variety of important roles. And even with the presence of Katharine Hepburn in African Queen, Bogart brought an aura of distinction to the movie. Let's go back to that picture and his Oscar-winning performance, as Bogie and Katie, who were actually feuding in the story, steamed downriver on the African Queen with all the physical hazards as well as the hazards of themselves.
Ah, it's a great thing to have a lady aboard with clean habits. Set the man a good example. Man alone, he gets living like a hog. Then, too, with me, it's always put things off. Never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. But with you, business before pleasure, every time. Do all your personal laundry, make yourself spick and span, get all the mending out of the way, and then, and only then, sit down for a nice, quiet hour with a good book.
I tell you, it's a model, like an inspiration. Well, I ain't had this old engine so clean in years, inside and out.
Just look at her, miss. See how she practically sparkles. Myself, too. Guess you haven't never had a look at me without my whiskers and all cleaned up. I bet you wouldn't hardly recognize me. Works that much of a change. Freshened you up, too. I only had some clean clothes like you. Now, you. Why, you could be at high tea.
Say, that's an idea, miss. How's about a nice little cup of tea?
Now, don't you stir. I'll be glad to make it for you. How's the book, miss? Well, not that I ain't read it. That is to say, my poor old mum used to read me stories out of it. How's about reading it out loud? I could sure do with a little spiritual comfort myself. And you call yourself a Christian. Do you hear me? Don't you? Don't you?
Miss, have a heart. Fair's fair. You gotta say something. I don't care what it is, but you gotta say something. I'll be honest with you, miss. I just can't stand no more of this. I just ain't used to it, that's all.
So you think it was your nasty drunkenness I minded?
Well, what else?
You promised you'd go down the river.
Miss, listen to me and try to understand. There's death a dozen times over down the river. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but don't blame me. Blame the Yolanga.
You promised.
Well, I'm taking my promise back.
All right, miss. You win. As the crocodiles will be glad to hear. Down the river we go.
That scene from African Queen, a memorable milestone in Humphrey Bogart's career. For each of his movies, he received $200,000 and occasionally was his own high-paid employee when working for Santana, his own movie-producing company. Bogey's eminently happy marriage to Lauren Bacall prompted them to think about making more pictures together. And one afternoon at their home in Benedict Canyon, I asked him if he thought it would be harmful to their separate careers to work together.
Oh, I can't think why it would be harmful. I think it would be a great help. I'd like to do it very much. We're looking for stories all the time. We've made a couple together, three together, as you know, and we're still married and expect to be for some time. As a matter of fact, I've purchased a book, which we might do in association with John Huston toward the end of this year, do it abroad. Its setting is in France and Spain.
Another romantic adventure?
Rather, kind of like a little on the order of the Maltese Falcon, oh, this one.
Wonderful.
Which would be nice.
I should think so.
No, I don't think that married people's working together, I think it's better for them than not to work together.
Working with the top actors and actresses was a pleasant enough pastime for Bogey, and he worked with them all. And as far back as 1942, when Rudy Vallee was Mr. Radio, Bogey joined Rudy, Joan Davis, and an actor he greatly admired, John Barrymore, in this comedy sketch.
All right, you two. Put him up. Reach for the ceiling.
What is this?
Quiet, Curly. Get your arms up. Get your arms up, and you too, sister.
Sure, I'll put my arms up.
Not around his neck. Miss Davis, be careful. This man is a thug.
Oh, I'd like to thug him and squeeze him.
Hey, sister, you ain't a bad-looking mole.
You mean mole.
I mean mole.
Hush, mister, you really are tough. You know, I never saw an outside gangster before.
Now, what do you mean outside?
Outside of my uncle and two brothers.
All right, enough of this gab. Where's the money, Curly?
Rudy! Rudy?
Pipe down, bud.
Who's this, another customer?
I'm Fogart the bad man. This is a stick-up.
A hold-up? I'd better phone the police. And tell him I want two tickets for the policeman's benefit.
Come on, Barrymore. Open a safe or I'll plug you.
Oh, you can't scare me. I can look you straight in the face and not flinch.
So what? I can look you straight in the face and not... Ah, you got me, pal. I can't do it.
When Bogey made Petrified Forest with Leslie Howard and Betty Davis,
It firmly established him as the number one movie gangster. And Bogie and Leslie Howard became close friends. His baby daughter, Leslie, is named after the actor. His star was on the rise, and so is his practical joking. And his willingness to speak on any subject never really got him into any trouble. Once when I told him that his chum, Earl Flynn, had named Hollywood's 10 characters and included him out, he responded with his own list of characters.
I think we ought to start off with my good friend Katharine Hepburn, who seems to top my list as I think it out quickly. She's a wonderful character. A man I only met once, John Barrymore, for whom I had the profoundest admiration. W.C. Fields, I would say, whom you all knew. I used to play golf with him. He was a wonderful character. Wilson Meisner, whom I met only once, but that one meeting was enough. He was the writer, as you know, probably one of the best known in the country. John Huston, who is most definitely a character. He is a very fine director of a great many very wonderful pictures. John Decker, the painter. John Decker happened to be also a great friend of John Barrymore's. I think you knew John Decker, George.
Yeah.
Charlie Butterworth, the actor, who was a good friend of mine. Let me see. Mark Hellinger, who was most definitely a character. Mark was a wonderful friend of all of us and a very fine man. But he was an individual. If you remember, he used to wear blue shirts and white ties, and I think he used to play at being a gangster once in a while. It was all part of his little acting business. He's a wonderful character. Let's see. Greta Garbo, I would say, was a character. She certainly departed from the beaten track, and she did as she pleased. And last but not least, my good friend Mike Romanoff is most definitely a character.
And Mike Romanoff permitted Bogie to appear at his exclusive restaurant without a necktie. Bogie and Betty had numerous and spirited differences of opinion. Betty refused to put foot on his $55,000 yacht, and Bogie refused to light her cigarettes, although he went halfway and presented her with a lighter. And despite the 25-year difference in their ages, each reflected pride, affection, and great respect for the other, for he was a devoted husband. And Humphrey Bogart wasn't one to go out to big, sumptuous Hollywood affairs, but he did make a few movie premieres, mostly his own, or those which starred his wife, Lauren Bacall. I emceed many of them, and I recall one he attended a few years ago, How to Marry a Millionaire, which starred Marilyn Monroe, Lauren Bacall, and Betty Grable. And Bogie and Betty attended with Marilyn Monroe and producer Nunnally Johnson.
Here comes Humphrey Bogart over to our microphone while his lovely wife is getting all the attention that is due her at her own premiere. Because Lauren Bacall goes through this sort of thing when her husband's pictures are premiered, which, as a matter of fact, was not so long ago when they made African Queen. She stood by while he took all the plaudits.
Good evening, George Fisher. I'm extremely proud and pleased to be here, and extremely proud to see that Nunnally Johnson has finally been photographed. He was complaining on the way down that nobody ever took a picture of him, and I said that if he would get in between Miss Lauren Bacall and Miss Marilyn Monroe, he couldn't miss.
You're so right.
George, thank you, and I think I should leave now, huh?
I think it's wonderful that you came over to tell us that cute story, and I think that I saw the picture yesterday, and I can only say that Lauren Bacall is just great in this picture.
I'm very pleased to hear that. I've heard it before, and I hope it's a tremendous success.
Thank you very much, Uncle Bogart. Bye-bye.
From the very moment Stanley Kramer read The Kane Mutiny, he, like so many others, decided instantly on Bogie for Captain Queeg. At 18, Bogie joined the Navy in World War I and served on the Leviathan. And in 1954, he was in the Navy again, this time commanding the Kane in the movie. It was expected that this would be his greatest role. That the movie failed somewhere did not lessen the fact that as Queeg, Bogart was likely to achieve a measure of secondhand immortality. Will you ever forget that memorable scene on the cane in the tremendous gale which precipitated Merrick, played by Van Johnson, taking over the command, which Queeg called mutiny?
Captain, this following sea is brutal. We need more knots to outrun it.
Race to engine control. This is the captain speaking. You down there in the engine room, I want power. Power on the starboard engine, do you hear? Emergency flank power. You want the ship to go down, we're in a typhoon. Close that door, it's August. Sir, relieve the watch. Pass the word to put on life jackets. It's difficult holding her, sir. The wheel feels loose.
Captain, I don't know whether we can keep on riding with our stern to the wind.
Those are fleet orders, Mr. Merrick.
I still think the depth charges should be put on safe.
Sir, the depth charges are on safe. Mr. Keeper gave me orders to set them.
Why wasn't I told these things? I can't go steaming around with a lot of dead charges.
Sir, I told Mr. Keefe.
You speak when you're spoken to. Mr. Keefe, put this man on the board for insolence and neglect of duty. Man, get another helmsman. Keep that idiot face out of my sight.
But still, Wells, our best man.
Will you stop this back talk? Isn't there one officer on this ship that pays attention to my orders?
Humphrey Bogart was a liberal Democrat, an avid reader, and a man who never drank when he worked, but on an occasion, loved to stay up till dawn. Hollywood often speculated on what kind of fellow he really was. For one, he was a man who could say he didn't trust anyone if he didn't drink. In fact, on that subject, his wonderful sense of humor goes a step further.
I'll tell you, I drink scotch. I drink it not only at home, but I drink it as anybody else does, before lunch, before dinner. Have one for the road, and so on and so on and so forth, just like anybody else does. Yes, I like scotch very much. As a matter of fact, it saved my life in Africa, old boy.
You mean keeping away from the fleas, the insects?
Oh, yes. Well, they kept away from me.
Tell me, do you like the reputation of being a character bogey?
Well, yes, I think it's good. I wouldn't like to be like everybody else. I don't think I go out of my way to be a character. I just am. I don't believe in doing things just to get publicity. I believe in doing what you feel like doing taking the consequences of whatever comes out of it.
You see what I mean? Bogey once told a Time magazine writer buddy, "I have politeness and manners. I was brought up that way. But in this goldfish bowl life, it is sometimes hard to use them. A nightclub is a good place not to have manners." And Bogey was publicity conscious, too.
Oh, yes. Well, I kind of like publicity. I think I if I hadn't been an actor, I might have been a publicity man or an advertising man. And it amuses me sometimes to confuse people, especially people here, you know, in the business, as to what I do with my private life and then my life, shall we say, in the newspapers. Yes. I feel somewhat the way Miss Katharine Hepburn feels about that. She says she doesn't care what anybody prints as long as it isn't true.
And who will ever forget his wonderful romancing of Audrey Hepburn and Sabrina with William Holden? An all-time favorite of his fans, Sabrina screamed for Bogart. And one of the highlights of that picture was this scene with William Holden on the subject of love and marriage.
It's all beginning to make sense. Mr. Tyson owns the sugar cane. You own the formula for the plastics. And I'm supposed to be offered up as a human sacrifice on the altar of industrial progress. Is that it?
You make it sound so vulgar, David, as if the son of the hot dog dynasty were being offered in marriage to the daughter of the mustard king. Surely you don't object to Elizabeth just because her father happens to have $20 million. That's very narrow-minded of you, David.
Just one thing you overlooked. I haven't proposed, and she hasn't accepted.
Oh, don't worry. I proposed, and Mr. Tyson accepted. Did you kiss him? Now, look, David. Elizabeth is one of the loveliest girls around. Sooner or later, you're going to propose to her anyway. I'm only trying to help you make up your mind.
Then why don't you marry her?
Me?
Well, what's so funny? You want to die an old maid?
Well, I was just thinking that if I were ever to get married, I'd have to take a dictaphone, two secretaries, and four corporation counselors along on the honeymoon. I'd be unfaithful to my wife every night of my married life, with vice presidents, boards of directors, slide rule accountants. This is my home. No wife would ever understand it.
Well, neither can I. You've got all the money in the world.
Well, what's money got to do with it?
If making money were all there was to business, it's hard to be worthwhile going to the office. Money is a byproduct.
Well, what's the main objective? Power?
Ah, that's become a dirty word.
Well, then what's the urge? You're going into plastics now. What will that prove?
Prove? Nothing much. A new product has been found, something of use to the world. So a new industry moves into an undeveloped area. Factories go up, machines are brought in, a harbor is dug and you're in business. It's purely coincidental, of course, that people who never saw a dime before suddenly have a dollar. And barefooted kids wear shoes and have their teeth fixed and their faces washed. What's wrong with the kind of an urge that gives people libraries, hospitals, baseball diamonds, and movies on a Saturday night? Miss Ricardo, will you send in the secretaries?
Yes, Mr. Larrabee.
Profile Humphrey Bogart. Some final words from this wonderful guy. Words that may never again be uttered in just the same way. For with Bogey's passing, a part of Hollywood's colorful history has left too. Tomorrow, John Huston, who perhaps knew Humphrey Bogart better than most, will deliver the eulogy at the services. And tonight, John Huston pays a personal tribute.
The first picture I made with Humphrey Bogart was back some years before the war. It was the Maltese Falcon. I'd written a couple of pictures for Bogart before that, but only then, while we were making the Falcon, did I get to know him really well. After the Falcon, we did another picture across the Pacific, and then the war came and I went away. I remember meeting Bogey in Italy during the war. He was over with an entertainment group, and there was a festive occasion when I met him at the palace at Caserta. Of course, I have memories of Bogey that are evoked when any one of the six pictures I made with him are mentioned. There was also Key Largo and Treasure of the Sierra Madre and African Queen and Beat the Devil. Those pictures carried us, I guess, around the world a couple of times. I had hoped to make six more pictures with Bogart, at least. The next one was to be in Afghanistan. And only the other day, Bogey said, "John, we've got to start thinking about this one now. Get it underway." He was planning to make it the very week of his death. When you live and work with a man, you get to know him pretty well. When I say living as closely as I did with Bogey, you get to know a man well. I mean just that, and the better I got to know him, the more I admired him. He was a very serious man about his work. He took great pride in being an actor. The face that he presented to the world was quite a different one than those who knew him truly well knew. In society, at Hollywood parties, why, he assumed the role of gadfly and tormentor of the fat cats. This gave allowed a misunderstanding to occur on the parts of those who only knew him slightly, who only saw him on those occasions. They thought of him as rowdy, bawdy, and gaudy. In truth, he was a very sincere, a deeply humble man, a very faithful man, faithful to his work, his friends, and finally, lastly, his family. He was a devoted father, and he loved his wife most dearly. It's a loss to the world, of course, that great talent. But the world can refer to it in the pictures that remain behind, those that he had done. The loss to his family and to his friends is therefore all the greater. There'll never be another Bogart.
NBC Radio.
A tribute to Humphrey Bogart on Tuned to Yesterday from January 16, 1957 on NBC. Bogart had passed away 2 days earlier, and his funeral was to be the day after that broadcast. The last movie he produced was 1956's The Harder They Fall alongside Rod Steiger and Jan Sterling, and his last radio appearance in an acting capacity was the Lux Radio Theater in December 1952, where he reprised his role as Charlie Allnut in an adaptation of the movie The African Queen. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeFounier. Now time for the syndicated series, Memoirs of the Movies, this episode called Hollywood at Home, syndicated for broadcast in 1959.
Here is your hostess, Miss Myrna Loy.
Thank you. The history of Hollywood is punctuated with scandals, breakdowns, suicides, even a murder or two. But I'm not going to revive those old nightmares. I must say that the price of stardom is very high, and the pressures within the industry are terrific. In the old days, actors were subjected to relentless publicity. If the studios could not actually own you, they could at least manipulate you in a way that sometimes put a severe strain on your private life. That publicity can be rather terrifying. Yet underneath it all, Hollywood was in many ways a company town. It had social classes, etiquette, and incessant shop talk, very much like any other American town that is dominated by a single industry. You're about to hear some recollections of Hollywood's social life, spoken in 1959 by people who were both rewarded and a little scorched by their sojourn in the movie capital. Your host will be Buster Keaton, who has since passed away. He was a dear fellow who made audiences laugh till they cried. Here he is with some bittersweet recollections of Hollywood at home during the 1930s and 40s and on into the 50s.
This is Buster Keaton. I remember the movies the way they used to be. Do you? Did you ever visit the most glamorous city in the world in its grandest, gaudiest days? Hollywood, the pot of gold at the end of the Santa Fe Railroad. Was it really a magical city where dreams and glory and glamour were guaranteed to come true? Or does it just seem that way to me in retrospect? To a lucky few, Hollywood was a land of plenty. There was outdoor living, exciting work, high rewards, and no bad publicity. The climate and scenery were spectacular. So were the salaries. There was sun and swimming and screen credits enough to go around. Today, Hollywood is an industrial suburb in the middle of a lot of other suburbs. But in the old days, well, listen to the indignant voice of Mr. Adolph Zucker, founder of Paramount Pictures.
There is no more immorality in Hollywood as far as pictures made as where you have a Klondike and where you have the Cripple Creek and where you have when gold was discovered in California. All kinds of people, all elements, gamblers, prostitutes, every conceivable is attracted from in there to make a quick buck. Whether it was through one way or the other way, but that's all. And Hollywood was exposed to that the same as Cripple Creek, the same as the Klondike, and the same as California. They rushed in there. And that period disappeared. It does in every case. That finally settled down. All of those people, the easy money was going. And the lush days are over, and now everybody buckles down to business.
The business of producing 52 pictures a year in a Klondike town grew up to be a mad, mythical city of luxury. Or did it?
I must say that once having arrived in Hollywood, if I had had any sense of glamour about the place, it wore off very quickly.
Melvin Douglas, recalling the days of his arrival in paradise.
There was a kind of particularly cheesy, synthetic quality about the whole thing that was anything but attractive. Quite the opposite. I have never forgotten a remark that Francis Starr made, who was there at the same time, who was also quite new to Hollywood. You know the expression in the theater, strike, which means tear down the scenery. Well, we were discussing our respective responses to Hollywood, and Francis said, yes, I know exactly what you mean. I often have the feeling that suddenly someone's going to say strike and the whole thing will come down.
Fred Allen once remarked, California's grand if you happen to be an orange, but if you happen to be a person, especially an actor from New York, it's bewildering. There were always problems for many in Hollywood. This exploding area of towns and freeways is the backdrop of all movie lives, and not a very pretty one, except for the scenery.
There's that one classic remark about Hollywood. I don't know who made it. It's been credited to a lot of people. They remark about no matter how hot it gets in the daytime, there is nothing to do at night.
According to Joseph L. Makowicz, producer of All About Eve and The Quiet American, the desert has never been pushed back.
This is quite literally true. But this is not the fault of Hollywood. This is the fault of the fact that God did not mean the human race to exist below Santa Barbara. Otherwise, he'd have put water in the ground. It's desert, and with luck, it'll be desert again when somebody turns off a tap.
This is a city in which they had a referendum about having a new public library system and an arts center, among other things. And as you know, in order for these things to pass, you need a two-thirds vote in favor. Well, the new library and arts center not only didn't get a two-thirds vote in their favor, but I think it's the only time in modern civilization in which a majority of the citizens voted against the library. This is a city of 2.5 or 3 million people with no theater, barely able to sustain 2 weeks of opera a year. This is the blight.
To Joseph Makowicz, the producer of many films, Hollywood is a city of refugees from New York, Paris, Vienna, Brooklyn. It has beautiful people and beautiful homes, and they give beautiful parties, and witty people that give witty parties. What are the Hollywood parties really like? Well, here you have two versions, one from Otto Preminger and Elliot Nugent. Mr. Preminger.
You see, it is a very strange thing which exists even now among the most talented creators of movies, but they never discuss movies among each other.
Do you agree, Elliot Nugent?
The social life was extremely interesting during those early years because we talked nothing but shop. And, I wouldn't say nothing but shop, but the shop was interesting to talk about because we were just finding a new medium, and when we met writers, directors, or actors who'd been out there, we were eager to exchange viewpoints. And a great many of them were learning from us, and we were learning from them. So parties were a lot of fun. The producers had a society of their own, and they would invite actors to their homes, but the actors didn't invite producers to their homes very much. We didn't feel very comfortable together. And then they were surrounded by a bunch of office employees, and when they had parties, they'd usually have producers and producers' assistants and story editors and people from the front office, not so many actors.
Could it be that Hollywood high life or low life was pretty much like life in other towns? As in most company towns, the salary list and guest list have something to do with each other. Cast and casting, the two status symbols went hand in hand, and for a while it could be very exciting, according to Mr. Walter Abel. Speaking of the middle 30s, in retrospect.
Hollywood was in the height of its glamour. The myth of Hollywood was then at the top in the minds of the public. Garbo was still extant, and Gable, and the whole lure was at its height. I was tempted, and I fell for it, and we entered, of course, with more money than we'd ever had in our lives, and but not enough to be asked into the inner circle. My salary of $1,000 or $1,500 a week was so modest that I never achieved the inner circle of the glamorous Hollywood life at all, nor did we care for it. The tragedies that happened out there by the advent of television were of such proportions that you wouldn't believe. You know, it's a pretty ghastly story, the fall of Hollywood. And, of course, so much of the glamour was false anyway, and not based upon anything solid. People who were receiving these enormous salaries in those days, now I'm talking pre-war, never saved anything. Only the few fortunate ones who had sense enough to do so, or had business managers or something, did do it. But when the bubble burst, there were, and still are, enormous tragedies.
In Hollywood, there does exist, perhaps not native to the soil, but that sensitive plant, the intellectual. The Hollywood variety is witty, but suntanned, and according to Dory Sherry, comes in two main species.
One level is the Romanov, Chasen, LaRue school. They're very fine restaurants. I don't want to indicate that I'm knocking them. But it's on that level that you find here in New York, among a certain echelon in the theater. All very social, well-dressed, weekends in Bermuda or 2 weeks in Jamaica. You find in that level a rather jauntist eye towards motion pictures themselves, a casual point of view, really, about politics. They're sometimes liberal-minded, but they very seldom do any work for the issues or for the causes. It's intellectual in that they read good books. They're au courant with the theater. Their magazine reading is fairly good. They travel abroad. They have a knowledge of the best restaurants. And some of them speak French and Italian quite well. It's largely cynical, a bit bored, well-fed, tanned, and somewhat blasé. That's one level. The second level is the level of the pure intellectual in terms of his effort. It's the group that concentrates on outside reading as much as it can. They discuss films. They discuss them in terms of how they can be improved and why can't the industry do this or do that. It's a level that finally has, I think, something to do about changing the attitude of the writer and the director towards the art of making motion pictures. It's more of a hopeful level. More driving, more passionate, more daring. I believe those are the two intellectual levels.
To Dory Sherry, who chooses to live in New York, Hollywood is a city of canyons, casting couches, and country clubs. It has always been an easy, obvious target for moralists and scandal mongers. Ever since the Arbuckle case, there's been plenty of scandal, of course. Possibly a little more than in other cities, but in these cities, there are not 400 hungry reporters with newspaper columns to fill.
I should say that Hollywood was no more, no less moral or immoral than any other city in the West.
Samuel Spiewak, now back in New York, notes a special kind of Hollywood morality and lack of it.
Hollywood was, for a large part of the time, wide open in the sense that you had gambling, you had call girls, you had that sort of thing, but then you had that in most of the Western cities. The fact that you had a bunch of girls coming into Hollywood to make careers and winding up as waitresses and so forth might give you raw material for the so-called vice business, but there wasn't really too much of that. It had the kind of mentality I found that it was best illustrated. They had a fellow who owned a building and loan association named Biesmeyer out there. And he managed to lose about $8 million of various worthy citizens' money, including some very poor people from Iowa and so forth. And quite a number of people committed suicide. And it was a great, great tragedy. And Mr. Biesmeyer, when he was being sentenced, really said this. And I quote this literally. I'm sure it's right. He said, "I want to say one thing. I never smoked or drank." And it's that kind of hypocritical morality that would lead people to burn, you know, Fanny Arbuckle's negatives and make a big to-do about somebody's divorce when they know that the sort of thing was going on all the time. The only thing they resented was the publicity.
Still, hypocrisy used to be balanced by an impulsive eagerness for life and excitement, and the old free and easy days are recalled, secondhand, by producer Edward Dimitri.
There was a lot of license and looseness in those days. I think there's no question about it. But when the work became more difficult, and actually, well, work was easy then. You didn't have to spend half the night worrying about what you were going to do the next day and how you were going to do it, because stories were very trite. Just a question of action. You didn't have to think about tomorrow. You went out and you ad-libbed and you got, you know, and you shot something. Some of the things were good, by the way, because there were a few people, but even some of our best, like von Stroheim, who was one of the good directors of the time, was actually one of the most licentious. He was one of the greatest libertines. I remember he shot The Golden Wedding, and in The Golden Wedding, they had a huge, huge party supposed to take place in Vienna. At which they had women from all over the world, and they just went wild. Well, he arranged to have it shot the last thing in the picture, and when he finished shooting, they closed it. They had all the liquor they wanted on the stage. They closed the doors of the stage, and for 3 or 4 days, they had a party on the stage. One of the leading character actors of that time died, actually. He had a heart attack from too much. He was quite a drinker anyway, and died on the stage, and that finally stopped the party.
This type of party didn't make the papers, as a rule. There were people to prevent it. But this type did, and caused readers astonishment and envy. Our speaker is a great Japanese actor, Sessa Hayakawa, star of The Bridge on the River Kwai, and a resident of Hollywood since the 20s.
I have to do it, you know. Each star has to take turn and invite them. In my house, I invite 250 for supper. And 600 for tea. That's why I need big... I built a castle. Just for that purpose, you know. Just to entertain the people. And there are almost all producers and actors and actresses, particularly during the prohibition, dry row. I had my cellar. I was stuck by a car roll, you know, car roll that I sent from Chicago. So I was very popular. I wasn't popular. My cellar was popular.
Actor Sessa Hayakawa, recalling Hollywood's most lavish parties, how splendid it all was and how tax-free. Hollywood still gives lavish parties in spite of the taxes. For the men talk shop and the women, well, what do Hollywood women do?
For a woman, I should think Hollywood is almost the most difficult place in the world to live.
Joe Makowicz again.
If you are the wife of a director or a writer or a producer, if you have any fear that you will lose your husband, this is a fear that you go through every time he leaves to go to the studio, because he's subjected to a never-ending supply of fresh, beautiful, young temptations, if he's attracted to them. For example, there's a little social a little social dressing note that exists in Hollywood that doesn't exist anywhere else. In New York City, there are black tie dinner parties. Because there are hostesses who say, "I'd like to put on a pretty dress tonight, therefore my husband's going to wear a black tie, and you girls put on a pretty dress, and we'll have the men wear black ties." There are black tie dinner parties. These are more or less accepted in a certain strata of society. In Hollywood, it is almost unheard of for men to be called upon to wear black ties. But women are always called upon to wear dinner gowns, dinner dresses. And it's not at all unusual to see women dressed to the teeth, wearing everything they've got, and the men coming just as they were at the studio. In other words, the home, again, the home, the occasion, the party, is again, this is a chance for the woman to show what she is, what she's got. Food has become a very important item because, again, it's a way for a woman to express herself. The furnishing of her home, the furnishing of her person, the food she lays out, and the magnificence of the party if her husband got the dough or the position. The wildness of the party is something they don't want. It's a highly competitive society, highly competitive, particularly on the non-professional wife level. And this is where the social structure exists.
Just an ordinary town, Hollywood, but perhaps it's better to be an orange than a woman there. Always the competition was tougher, stakes higher or thicker, and so much money around that everything seemed larger than life. Albert Hackett, author of the screenplay of The Diary of Anne Frank, mourns those who had it, and like D.W. Griffith, lost it.
In California, they say, in Hollywood, they say, you're as good as your last picture. They're constantly looking for somebody and saying, well, he's been up there a long time. Any moment now, they'll pull the rug out from under him, or he'll find that he has no longer an audience. And when a picture goes out and it doesn't make money, then they become very suspicious that the man is slipping. The moment they think somebody has no longer got that magic touch for them, they don't speak to them. Even the gate man, you know, won't speak to them. This is where they're really, really rough. An actor, an actress, an actor, and a director, the way they fuss over a director and an actor and an actress, and when they lose, it breaks your heart. You know, they're still dressing the same way, looking the same way, and living the same way, and not making any money. It's very discouraging. And you see so many people just destroyed so quickly.
I don't think Hollywood was any more cruel, or is any more cruel, than in any other place.
The acid tongue of Samuel Spiewak, writer and habitual dissenter.
We live in a functional world. A man who loses his job on a newspaper, let's say, loses his job and loses a good many of his so-called friends. He keeps his real ones, but the people who used them and found him useful no longer find him useful, and therefore they sort of drop him. Well, the same thing happens out in Hollywood. If you no longer can give people jobs, they're not really interested. I don't think that it was cruel. It was more dramatic in its cruelty, because people are picked up and carried along, and then suddenly dropped on their heads. They forget these people are zeros anyway. They're ciphers, and by dint of some accident, they get in a position of power or popularity, and then they lose it. Well, it's too bad. You know, it's a little fairy tale has worked out here, and the prince and princess should live happily ever after. Instead of which, the prince, you know, loses his throne, and he's just a jerk, which he always was anyway.
Still, Hollywood's tragedies are never quite forgotten. Wally Reed, Mabel Normand, John Gilbert, and there are other tragedies of the cast and casting system that will never be remembered. The little people who gamble on success and lost, the victims of exploitation, ambition, caught up in the tide of an industry that showed no mercy.
So many of them came from vaudeville and the theater. Those were the young girls that brought in.
Miss Frances Merriam, MGM's top screenwriter, cannot forget the girls who failed.
They, we used to stay up at night till 12, 1 o'clock. The studio demanded that they report that 7:30 in the morning. These girls, not used to that kind of life, began to take sleeping pills to get to sleep. In the morning, they were groggy, so they were given pills to awaken them. Benzedrine is the thing, until it was habit forming. And it wrecked many young girls with tremendous talent, broke homes. They never ate properly. Their hours were irregular. And even with sleeping pills, it's difficult to change 20 years of their... 16, 18, 20 years of their lives.
The skyrocket girls who paid the price of success and lost Hollywood's most prized commodity, their youth. As Hollywood has lost its own today, now it's just another company town. A Pittsburgh on the Pacific, a Scranton in the sunset. It has a flavor, an excitement, perhaps only a memory that makes it unique. At least that's the way it seems to me, in retrospect. This is Buster Keaton from Hollywood.
This is Myrna Loy again. I know about the skyrocket girls. You wonder if perhaps Norma Jean Baker and Frances Gumm, who changed their names to Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland, might have been happier if they had never been movie stars. To survive in Hollywood as a person, you had to be very, very stubborn and very sure of what you want. And sometimes you just had to escape. That's why some of my happiest moments were spent on the train back to New York. Now, of course, the whole social structure of Hollywood has collapsed. The film business is international and totally involves the theater, television, and 100 other enterprises. It's a whole new industry and a new way of life.
You've been listening to part 10 of Memoirs of the Movies. Join us again tomorrow at 8:30 as we continue this spoken history of the silver screen.
Memoirs of the Movies, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1959. Wrapping up this hour of true history from Hollywood, on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonia. It's been a pleasure.